Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Developers often say how expensive it is to build affordable housing, even with deal-making and trade-offs from government. Just as often, the units are apartments. But the nonprofit Habitat for Humanity is known for its affordable home builds, and at the end of this summer, there will be 10 new ones in West Hawaii. We wondered about how those homes will be built, how much they'll cost, even with volunteer labor and donated construction material, and how all of it will happen over 10 days in September. Patrick Kearney is the executive director for Habitat for Humanity West Hawaii and recently announced the build. He's on the line now. Aloha.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
Now, we know that a house can mean many different things. What are the descriptors of a Habitat house?
Well, Habitat builds simple, decent, affordable homes and provides home ownership opportunities for families with limited income.
That part we know about it, but in terms of if you had to give me a walking tour of the house virtually, what would that look like?
Oh, it's kind of a single floor layout, kind of a rambler, three bedroom, two bathroom, kind of open kitchen with a countertop that leads into the living room in the front of the house, and these homes have a nice little carport and two lanais off the sides as well.
What's the square footage?
The square footage of the house is about 1,100 square feet.
So we're talking about, in some cases, the size of an apartment or a condo, but at least having the ability to be freestanding and a little bit more private. At this point,
exactly.
When you're starting to look at all this, and I realize that you've been doing this in the planning stage for the last couple of years, but since the last build that you did in, I think, 2012, what has changed for you in trying to now double the amount of houses that you did in 2012? What has been happening to be able to make these 10 houses a possibility?
Well, the 2012 Blitz build, as you mentioned, we did 5 homes in 10 days, and that went relatively smoothly. And we thought that this being our 15-year anniversary here in West Hawaii, that we could double down on that and do 10 with, fairly the same amount of prep time with and probably a double the size of the volunteers, which we've been grooming and developing. One of our big programs is the Global Village program, where we host teams from all over the world, but mainly from U.S. and Canada, and they come and build for a week here. And so we're actually hosting 10 Global Village teams on the site, along with another organization called the Blitz Home Builders, and they are an organization that chooses a Habitat affiliate every year, and leads Blitz builds for the affiliate. So they're coming back again.
The point that you're making is that going into this whole project, you know that you're reliant on external volunteers in this very highly networked way. But I'm also curious about the costs of the homes, because in 2012, it wasn't all that long after the Great Recession, and construction costs were lower. And here we are now, 5 years later, and we've been watching those costs escalate in lots of different projects. But I'm wondering how that has affected your ability to not only turn out 5 homes, but now 10.
Yes, that is true. And our costs have gone up as well. We have a great partnership with the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, and they are able to access federal funds through HUD. And so the cost of construction is pretty much intact.
How much does it cost to build a house?
We're estimating the three-bedroom, two-bath home to be around $145,000.
And that's your cost to build it?
Correct.
And then is that what somebody is able to purchase it for?
Yes. And then what we do is, in partnership with the Hawaiian Homelands, we set up a mortgage for the family, a 30-year mortgage based on what it cost us to build. plus a 10% admin fee that we have to keep our doors open. And the family gets a 30-year mortgage at no interest.
Now, very clearly, this is targeting a specific population. But as we always hear about how difficult it is to have affordable homes built, that they're so dependent upon obviously having infrastructure, you can only put this into places where there, I would take it, already be that infrastructure?
Correct, yes. On the DHHL properties, put in all the infrastructure for us.
And how much more room is there? How many more houses could that area accommodate?
Well, they also were able to allow us to use 10 vacant lots across the street, which we'll use for setup and staging of the home. So there's plenty of room there. And I believe they have plans to build 165 more homes, rent-to-own projects that we hope to be involved with as well in the future.
Clearly, even given the fact that those numbers don't sound huge, given the thousands that were already behind the curve, but to every lucky family who gets to occupy one of those homes, it's more than just a roof over their heads. There's a sense of ownership and stakeholdership with that. How much more would you like to be able to do in the next 5 years apart from this particular project? Is there anything else for you that you're scoping at this point?
Yes, we have a very aggressive strategic plan. Our goal is to build 75 homes in the next 5 years. With probably another blitz build in between there. But, you know, we feel like we need to make a bigger dent in our community with affordable housing. So
And forgive me for interrupting you, but we have to go in just a second, though. But because we hear from developers who say, look, our jobs are to make, you know, good product and good money. And yes, we like to turn back to the community, and some have. Do you find yourself at odds at all with developers for not doing more of what you've been able to do or that you would like to do?
I haven't come across that. Most of the developers support us. We'll be tapping them to help with some of the construction. Our local Carpenters Union is a huge supporter of Habitat, and they will be coming out and volunteering. So it's really been a great partnership. Everybody understands and believes in the mission of Habitat.
Well, we wish you all the best, and look forward to seeing pictures of those new houses come the end of September. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bethan.
Patrick Kearney is the Executive Director for Habitat for Humanity West Hawaii. The organization will build 10 homes in 10 days, starting September 13th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, the enduring value of first impressions. But first, your quiz.
Later in the program, we'll be joined by slack key guitarist Jeff Peterson. Slack key is a staple of modern Hawaiian music, and its cousin is the ukulele. For today's quiz, we're going to take a look at a recent addition to the ukulele family of instruments called the ukulele bass, or bass uk for short. It's likely you've seen and heard soprano, concert tenor, and baritone ukuleles countless times before, but ukulele basses have only just begun to catch on with the public. That's partly because California-based ukulele company Kala has been mass-producing a line of ukulele basses called U-Bass. But Kala wasn't technically the first to create an ukulele bass. They merely altered and replicated the models and designs of a man named Owen Holt, operator of Road Toad Music. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of Owen Holt's original ukulele-based design that was ultimately reproduced and popularized by Kala under the name U-Bass? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And if you're first and right, you walk away with a prize.
Aloha, I'm Marcia Rose Joyner. If you like today's music, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org for a playlist.
It isn't always easy to trust our intuition, but we often find after the fact that our first impression was a fairly accurate one. That notion is at the heart of Dr. Susan Scott's message. She's the current president of the Inner Peace Movement of Canada, in town to connect with Hawaii's Inner Peace Movement, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Susan. Thanks
Hello.
For coming in.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You know, we've all had first impressions turn out to be accurate. We've also had times in our lives probably where we didn't trust our first impression and later wished we had. Has that been your experience in people you talk to?
Yes. Many people say, you know, I knew something was going to happen and I didn't listen and I wish I had. Mm-hmm. And then other people say, you know, I had an impression about that and I followed it and it worked and I'm eternally grateful I did. So I think that's a common experience of people.
Well, how do you bring that, you know, how does a person bring that under control? We're talking about things that are not based in fact, right? We're talking about some pretty vague impressions that we get, aren't we?
This is true. You can't prove that you had a feeling or a hunch or an impression, but we do that.
Yeah.
Everybody does. I think the thing to me, Chris, is not thinking too much. We tend to be kind of analytical and we doubt ourselves. You know, you might get a feeling about something and think, no, that can't be right. And we kind of look for the logical reason, when if we just trust that gut feeling, that gut instinct, it is right. And so in a way, that is a fact. If we have a certain feeling about something, that's a fact.
Well, thinking might involve marshaling facts at our disposal that argue against doing something, that are things that might well be worth thinking about.
I think we need a balance between the intellect and the feelings, between the head and the heart, between the conscious and the unconscious, because our feelings, our heart, will tell us the right way to go. But then we need to organize the facts that tell us yes or no so we can stay organized. Otherwise, we get disorganized and we're all over the place. So we do need to have a balance of the two, you know, that gut instinct, but understand what it is that we have been sensing.
Well, because first impressions can also lead to disaster, can't they?
It depends where the impression comes from. If we're thinking too much or just an idea, then that could lead to disaster. But 9 times out of 10, that gut instinct is right on.
Well, it's that 10th time that I'm thinking about, you know, and wondering how one prevents, you know, one does want to proceed, you know, along some sort of rational course and avoid pitfalls. And without a really quantifiable way to do that, I'm wondering how you proceed.
Well, I think it comes with practice. At least that's been my experience. And I've been doing this stuff for like 40-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to really know what to follow and what not to follow and what instincts to trust and which ones, you know, maybe I should look more into this before I, you know, jump in. And it's a matter of learning to gauge how I feel within myself. Sometimes I have just an inner certainty and I just do it because I know that's the right thing to do. But then other times it'll feel like, well, I'm not quite sure. And that's when I go and look for more facts to show me whether this might be a good course of action or it could be leading me into disaster.
How does you know, how does a method that has worked for you translate into something that you can teach others?
Well, one of the things I do is I show people very simple techniques, how to listen to themselves. And we do it in different ways. Actually, there are four different ways which we perceive things. Some people get a picture in their mind. I mean, you might be driving along, you get a picture of a traffic jam on a certain road. You think, well, I think I won't go that way. I'll go a different route. And but that little picture is an indication of what to, you know, watch out for. Other people will get a feeling, just a gut feeling that something feels right or it doesn't feel right. There's something not quite in place. Other people will get a thought, an idea. We're just almost hearing it in their head. And then the fourth way is that people will have an inner knowing, just a hunch or just a knowing. You just know and you don't know how you know, but you know.
This all moves toward, I guess, what you'd have to call extrasensory perception, or an area of understanding beyond the accepted notions of what the mind can and cannot do.
Exactly. It is. It's outside the sort of logical thing. But we have those two parts to us. We have to remember we have those two natures. We have our intellect, which is analytical and likes to have facts, so it understands. But then we have that whole realm of the feelings that you cannot really put a label on. You can't prove them. But you just have a feeling. You have a gut instinct about something. And you can't prove it until it turns out one way or the other.
How does following impulses or gut feelings lead to inner peace?
Well, for me, personally, it helps me to do the right thing at the right time. It helps me to save time rather than run around like a chicken with its head cut off. I could take the simplest, easiest route. And so it helps me to live life less stressfully, put it that way, and avoid the pitfalls, avoid things that might come up that might be unpleasant. And it just makes life easier. It makes it simpler. And I know even when I'm driving, I just follow my feelings so I can go in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And or if I'm going shopping, I mean, simple everyday things like going shopping. I know what I need and I go to the place where I need it. You know, I live in Montreal in Canada, and that we have wonderful shopping there, you know, because the French are very much into it. But I can go to precisely where I need to go when I need to get something. So I don't waste time going all over the place.
But that can't work all the time, can it?
9 times out of 10, it works for me because I've learned to trust it. I've learned to listen to it and to trust it.
So when people come to one of your lectures, that's the place you want them. That's what you want them to feel as they walk out?
What I like to do is to help people understand a bigger picture of themselves, who they are, the potential that they have, and how when they listen to that, they can do more with their life of whatever it is that they want to do. And they realize that they don't have to worry about things. You know, we have a bad habit of worrying. And they realize that they don't have to worry if they just learn to listen to what they have and to realize, too, that they have a purpose. We all have a purpose in life. And if we listen to that, listen to what our instincts are telling us, we will get more into our niche in life. And that's when things go easier for us.
Well, that's something everybody would very much like to have happen. So thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Sure. Dr. Susan Scott is the current president of the Inner Peace Movement of Canada. She and Shannon Papanen, Hawaii director of the Inner Peace Movement, are giving talks open to the public on Tuesday, May 16th at 1 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. at the Blaisdell Center Oahu Room on Ward Avenue in Honolulu. And you can get details on our Facebook page, The Conversation. Thanks very much.
on from that peaceful interlude to this. Next week, the battle over the injunction of the president's executive order on immigration comes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. A big question is whether the court should consider the president's words along with the executive order itself. CivilBeat.org reporter Louis Kinnea has today's reality check. Hi, Louis.
Good morning.
Taking a look at what may be happening come Monday, the real question is, will they pay attention to those six words that he said before the president signed the travel ban? We all know what that means. Those are the six words that seem to be causing a great deal of consternation.
Yeah, that's one of the statements he's made. And obviously, we have also heard of all kinds of other statements he's made during the campaign and also after the election. And so the kind of the statement everybody kind of talks about when they really consider whether or not travel ban is legitimate, and you know, it comes down to whatever their decisions. But when it comes to, you know, whether what judges should do at the Ninth Circuit next week, it is kind of still up in the air whether you should be actually considering these statements, because there are kind of two different sets of opinions from the Supreme Court that talks about this particular issue.
Louis, I just want to stop you there for a second, because you're really talking about, are you looking at just the executive order? Is that what they're supposed to do? Or is it being contextualized by other things that we've heard from the president? That seems to be where that division is, isn't it?
Exactly. Those are the questions. And it's still, we don't even know whether we can actually consider the statements. And, you know, large part of Hawaii's lawsuit kind of rests on whether or not you can actually consider those statements. And if you can, then obviously the case would be much stronger for the Hawaii's part. But, you know, the Supreme Court has said in the past that, well, in the cases of immigration decisions of the executive branch, maybe you should not be actually considering those kind of stuff, so long as, you know, they have the legitimate reasons for putting out certain policies or even denying some of the visas some people. So those are the things the Ninth Circuit has to decide.
Is there a precedent for that?
Yeah, there is a whole bunch of precedents on both cases. So if you're actually considering those statements in Establishment Clause cases of First Amendment, then courts have said in the past that you definitely should be looking at the context. But those are usually the domestic cases. But if you deal with immigration context, then there is another set of precedents, and they basically talks about, hey, the executive branch should have the deference from the court, and so long as they have legitimate reason for doing something, then they should be okay about that.
And really quickly, what does Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin have to say about it?
Well, you know, he's obviously making a call that, hey, all these statements are just way too blatant. This is something that, you know, the judges should be actually looking into.
But not going, you know, back into history so much, but really maintaining a much more narrow focus on it?
Right. So basically, you know, there are some people who are saying, well, okay, well, if you can consider the past statements, how far can you go? Can you go back to the statements from 20 years ago? Is that fair? But, you know, Doug Chin is basically making a case that this is just, you know, so recent and so relevant to the case that we should be considering them.
All right. Thank you. We'll be watching this come Monday.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Have a good weekend. Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org. Today featuring reporter Louis Kinnea. And it being a Friday, we will take a look at what our news department is working on for the coming week. And to help us do that, HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. All right. So what are we doing? We're renaming a school.
Yeah. Aloha, Bethann. This is an interesting one. So Lanikai Elementary Public Charter School, changing its name to Ka'oha'o Public Charter School, going back to the original Hawaiian name of the area. You know, Lanikai, something, it's one of these situations of 1920 real estate developers, and there are a lot of these around town of changing names. And it's one of those twists of language, because Lanikai, he thought he was saying heavenly sea, but in Hawaiian, the modifier usually comes afterwards. So actually, it means sea heaven. But at any rate, this is in terms of the twists and turns of the language, the cultural history of this going back and the significance of that. And fortunately, our listeners will have a far better guide than I for the story. Ku'uwehi Hiraishi, our newest reporter here at Hawaii Public Radio, bringing a lot more in the story, the background leading up to it, and why the examination of language is something that is growing in different parts of the islands.
And if we're going to see some other renamings happen along with this.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting sort of sub-area that's out there. Yeah.
Which begins to move us into the direction of arts and culture. What do we have happening there?
It sure does. Well, a couple of interesting folks and their stories this week. Noe Tanigawa bringing us along Kaori Ukaji, an installation artist from Hilo, featured in an artist right now, exhibit right now, rather, at the Honolulu Museum of Art, Artists of Hawaii. By the way, next Thursday is the 7th annual Art Museum Day. Honolulu Museum of Art, one of more than 150 museums across the country taking part. So you can get in free, among other things, but it's a great day to go to the museum.
Plug in, a great thing to go do. Yeah. And we still have to look at some issues of politics and city council.
Sure.
And what money will say.
You know, money talks, and there are going to be money talks next week. Budget's coming. The budget is coming. June 7th, the final passage for the executive budget. But ahead of that, hearings and discussions, one next week. Also, council talk about other taxes and fees, boosting charges for parking meters. That'll get a little bit of reaction. But Wayne Yoshioka will track that all down.
All right. And we'll be oh so happy
yes.
how we're going to be spending more money. Bill Dorman, thank you so much.
You bet.
Every week we take a look at what's happening in our news department that will show up on the radio in the coming week. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And as you know, on Fridays, we read your letters and emails. After our recap of the 2017 legislative session on Town Square, Frank Sullivan from Mountain View said this on Twitter: "Our state needs our taxpayer dollars for other islands. The state should not pay for Oahu rail issues. Oahu should."
After last week's interview on North Korea and missile defense with retired Air Force General Dan Leaf, we had this exchange on Twitter. Bill Kanegi of Shell Knob, Missouri asked, "And why does Hawaii not have missile defense?" Timothy Blair said that they do not have it is very disturbing.
After my conversation with exonerated death row inmate Isaiah McCoy, Dennis Ayon wrote on Facebook, "The judiciary system is not about justice. Real justice happens when what goes around comes around."
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter. Or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
At the legislature this year, a bill to ban sunscreens with oxybenzone failed. Supporters say it'll be back. Meanwhile, concerned consumers looking for alternatives have sometimes been bamboozled by what appeared to be reef-safe skin protection, only to find chemicals lurking. Rhode Island lifeguard Captain Brian Guadagno decided to take matters into his own hands and turned his kitchen into a lab to research and formulate a healthy sunscreen. He's now head of the Raw Elements brand, and he's in Hawaii to talk about reef and people-safe sunscreens. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What led you to decide to take this on?
Well, I think it all stemmed from identifying a problem in my own life and finding a need for a safe sunscreen. At about 7 years ago, became aware of the harmful effects of chemical sunscreens for personal health and also environmental health. And I set out on a quest to try to find a natural alternative, and I was just never happy with what was available, from the aesthetic qualities to lack of performance that the natural sunscreens at the time offered. And through this period of discovery, I really identified a problem, and I wanted to be able to share the solution with friends and family and you know, really kind of bring attention to this issue.
So you weren't necessarily looking to create something to market. You just wanted something that was going to work for you in your life as a lifeguard and with friends and family.
Correct. And after, you know, really being dissatisfied with what was available, one of the other things I really noticed were the natural sunscreens that I was kind of purchasing and finding. I felt that the brands were very sterile and didn't speak to me, and certainly not to a broader audience. And,
sterile in what way?
Just very segmented to a specific consumer that they were, you know, trying to speak to, and I felt that this was a larger issue than that. And
so, but before you move on, when you say a specific consumer, what kind of consumer?
I think a lot of times it was more of a very, very, very natural-minded person, or a person that was maybe finding this in like a spa channel, and you know, I just felt that this was such a large problem, and you know, the general active consumer needed accessibility to, you know, to a safe, effective sunscreen. So, you know, through that process, I kind of, you know, figured that there needed us to be a solution.
How long did it take you to get something that worked?
So I turned my kitchen into a lab, as you mentioned, and the development at home went on for about 9 months in that initial phase, until I got to a point where I felt like I had something that was really a safe and effective sunscreen and worked for me.
There are other people who have kind of come out of that cottage industry idea of trying to do something that worked well for themselves, and then suddenly found themselves with other people wanting it. Is there now a movement among others like you, sort of a coalition, if you will, of small marketers who are creating something and, in fact, challenging the commercial folks that we see lining the shelves of just about every drugstore?
There are. There's a number of you know, natural sunscreen brands that we've collaborated on different initiatives over the years, and specifically now, a Safe Sunscreen Council is being formed. And, you know, these brands all meet a specific criteria in terms of ingredients, authenticity of product, reef-safe ingredients. And
this is more than just oxybenzone?
Correct. Oh, no, yeah. It's quite specific. The active ingredients can only be non-nano zinc oxide, non-nano titanium dioxide. So the sole active ingredients there, you know, none of the preservative ingredients, no chemicals, and meet a particle size definition on the active ingredient as well.
As this council is now sort of in its nascent form, how long until you think that this is going to be an active and lobbying voice?
Well, I think hopefully soon, because all of the brands involved are already in this practice together. So it's now just a matter of, you know, identifying, you know, what the communication is and where we can be effective, and what information and education we want to, you know, provide to the consumer, but also to legislative bodies and industry as a whole.
How many components? How many people are in this, or how many companies?
I think right now there's about a half a dozen brands that are, you know, sort of the founding members, and obviously they'll be adding brands to it. I think it's a council that a lot of other brands would like to be involved with.
When you try to approach each other, Is there a sense of real comradeship in having to do this, that you're sort of, you know, brothers in arms with all this, as opposed to, you could take my market share?
Yeah. No, I think there is. And I think it starts with the understanding and the recognition that between the brands that, you know, they're all, you know, out there doing what they feel is best. And we all share that sort of unifying position. And, you know, obviously each brand has different nuances. And the way that they might communicate, or, you know, the way that they present their brands to their specific audience. But as a whole, you know, if we can let more people know that, you know, there's safe alternative options out there, and, you know, these are the types of products that the consumer should be using for safety and efficacy, then everyone wins. And I think that we all share that, you know, that together.
Baby products have come under scrutiny in recent times. In looking at some of the sunscreens made for babies, you've made the point that there's a lot of junk in there that parents don't necessarily realize because they're only looking for a few specific things. What do you say should not be in a children's sunscreen?
Well, I think first and foremost, what should be in there is zinc oxide, non-nano zinc oxide, as the sole active ingredient. It's the safest ingredient. It's an FDA category one skin protectant. It's used in, you know, diaper cream. It's a mineral. And from there, you really want to look and make sure that all of the ingredients, the inactive ingredients, you can pronounce, you understand.
But what about fragrance? I mean, very often they have nice little fragrances to them, but you don't know necessarily what's in that fragrance.
Yeah, the term fragrance is a way for any sunscreen or any cosmetic to mask literally up to 5% of the formula. So under that term fragrance, there can be a whole litany of other ingredients. So fragrance-free is truly the best way to go. If the fragrance can be avoided, that's definitely advised.
As you and your fellows have been talking to people wherever you go, and here you're in Hawaii to talk about this now, have you felt targeted by the big boys?
I think that we haven't specifically, but, you know, we know that the legislation was targeted by big industry and will continue to be. So, you know, I think it's about finding ways to communicate direct to the consumer and direct to our audience and, you know, sort of circumvent the noise or the distraction. And fortunately today, through social media and, you know, different types of activations, we find it, you know, very easy to speak directly to our audience. And I know that the other brands do as well.
And maybe catch that wave that we saw happen with organic produce. And then now you can walk into a, you know, mainstream grocery store and find it. We wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you for
being
here.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Guadagno is a Rhode Island lifeguard captain and the brains behind Raw Element sunscreens formulated without chemical blockers. He's in Hawaii to talk about chemical sunscreens.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we took a look at a new member of the ukulele family called the ukulele bass, or bass uke for short. They're similar in size to baritone ukuleles and are usually strung with a unique type of polyurethane strings that help to replicate the sound of a full upright bass. Owen Holt, operator of Road Toad Music, was the original designer of the ukulele bass, which has since been adapted and mass-produced by other manufacturers. For today's quiz, we wanted you to tell us the name of Owen Holt's original ukulele-based design that was ultimately reproduced and popularized by Kala under the name U-Bass. That name was the Big Bufo Bass, and along with the Big Bufo Bass, Holt also pioneered the unique polyurethane strings that give the instruments their bassy sound. And no one got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you've got fun for us, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.com.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
Guitarist Jeff Peterson, who grew up on Maui immersed in the sounds of slack key, has forged a career in music by expanding the boundaries of the style while remaining true to its fundamental spirit. It's not an easy balance to maintain, but Jeff's grounding in jazz and classical technique has given him the tools to innovate. He's performing at the Honolulu Museum of Art tonight, and he's with us now in our studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, aloha. How are you?
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Your style, you know, has covered a lot of bases over the times you've been performing. And what did you want to do as a guitarist starting out? What was your first focus?
I grew up on a ranch in Maui. My father was a paniolo at the Haleakala Ranch, so I heard a lot of Hawaiian music played, and that really got in my ear at a very early age. And I was very fortunate to hear live music as a kid, and there were little backyard concerts and back porch concerts happening all the time. And I just wanted to join in. I wanted to join the party and be able to play. And so I started playing, learning basic chords and accompaniment. My dad taught me some things. He did, like if you've ever had poi, there's a real thick poi. There's one finger poi, two finger poi, three finger poi.
Right.
Same with guitar. He would just use two fingers and get quite a bit of sound. And a lot of the traditional slack key players do that. Once I started getting into it, I branched off and like most kids got an electric guitar and started playing blues and rock and roll and everything. I then got interested in classical guitar and jazz. I studied at the University of Southern California, had some great teachers, also Ben Verdery, who's the head of the Yale guitar program. He does a master class on Maui.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got exposed to all this great music and started delving into all the things that are different about different styles of guitar playing. And the more and more I got into it, I realized how similar things are. So classical technique, fingerstyle technique, is something that works great with playing kiho'alu. You use your fingers in a similar way. So I thought it was a very natural way to blend the different ideas together. And with jazz, improvising is a big part of that music.
Sure.
And in Hawaiian music, we love to improvise as well, taking what's called a pa'ani, a solo.
And the whole idea of all those styles that you mentioned is to make, in the way you approach it, is to make the guitar a self-contained miniature orchestra.
Definitely, absolutely. Yeah, by extending the range of the tuning with kiho'alu, you get a wider range of sound. You mentioned the U-bass a second ago, and in a way that's what the paniolos were doing with slack keys. By slacking the bass strings, suddenly you get a bass part there too, so you can play melody, bass, and accompaniment all together.
And you don't have to go very far from original tuning to really expand that range. You drop your bass strings a couple of whole steps and you've got a whole new instrument, don't
you? Yeah, and there are so many variations. That's what I find really exciting about slack key, is that there are probably about 25 or more tunings that are used all the time, and then a whole list of other tunings that are very specific to different players or particular songs. Like I've change the tuning around in my guitar and found something I really like, and I'll just have one song that I play in certain tunings that I've created for a piece. Other tunings I get really, really into, and I feel very free in those tunings, so then I can improvise and do other things.
Well, if you're going for that one song, that might be inspired by just that little bit extra you can get out of a bass string or a different chord interval that just sounds just right in that tuning.
Yeah, the guitar, it actually feels different with different tunings. It resonates in a different way. It's amazing how it changes with one tuning to another. And as a composer, it just frees up thinking. If you're into usual finger patterns and all that, it's all out the window. All the fingers go in different places to get the chords.
It's good to open your mind like that sometimes, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a really great, exciting way to kind of get a perspective of things. But the more I've done it, I've spent years, you know, diving into this, and there are only a certain number of intervals between notes that you can tune strings in, and so you'll start to find similarities between tunings based on what the intervals are.
Sure.
Usually I'm in right now, I brought my guitar and it's in standard tuning, the Spanish tuning, and it's tuned in a fourth, then a fourth, a fourth, a third, and then a fourth. So it's basically stacked fourths. So a lot of what slack key would do, there might be more seconds or thirds or fifths or wider spaces, even sixths in some of the tunings.
Some closer, some wider.
Yeah. And so that makes where you'd put your fingers, it can relate between different tunings, because maybe from one tuning to another, there's still that fourth in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I find that tunings do relate together because of that, but then the sound is so different.
And our Western ears are really trained to hear those fourths and fifths. It's like we've got to hear them at some point, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're in regular tuning now, and you brought in a piece that you're going to be performing at tonight's concert, which is kind of about the different regional influences you've gotten out of music over the years.
Yeah, I have. Tonight's program will feature a lot of slack key music and a lot of original music, but then I'm going to do a bit of a tour around of places I've been to through travels and through the State Department with Keola Beamer and his lovely wife, Moanalani. For the past 4 years, we've gone to do cultural ambassador programs and education programs. We've been to Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, Zimbabwe. We've also been to Cambodia and China. And all along the way, I go sort of as a student as well as a performer to soak up things that I've heard. And I just love the way that the guitar, I feel like, in a way, like an archaeologist is looking at an old temple and trying to find things there. I try to find connections like, wow, the Portuguese also brought the braguinha to Brazil, and that became their version of the ukulele, like we have here. And they have other types of instruments that made it there that are popular that aren't here. There's a five-string guitar that's called a viola caipira in Brazil, and I just love the sound, and it was amazing. It's their slack key guitar.
Well, Jeff, before we run out of time, let's hear a little bit of what you've got to play here.
Okay, I'm going to play Tango from Argentina. It's actually written by a French composer, Roland Dienz.
Wonderful bounce to that tango rhythm, isn't there, Jeff?
Absolutely, yeah.
You could really almost see the dance in that piece. That was terrific. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the concert tonight.
Jeff Peterson will perform tonight at 7:30 in the Honolulu Museum of Arts, Doris Duke Theater. As we go into the weekend, it's time to think about activities going on throughout the state, many of them under the radar, and that's where we turn to Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, who keeps track of such things. Hi, Derek. Thanks
Hello,
for coming
Chris.
In.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
What have we got today?
Well, Seabury Hall's 44th Annual Craft Fair is happening tomorrow. offering a family fun for this Mother's Day weekend, and it features family entertainment, boutique shopping, a wide array of food booths and music, live and silent auctions, and more. This fair has been raising money for the school for financial aid since 1973. There is a small admission fee for adults, but children under 12 are free. Seabury Hall's craft fair is from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. tomorrow at the school's campus in Makawao.
I suspect there'll be plenty for children to do, too.
Oh, yes, I'm sure.
Keep those kids busy, right? Mm-hmm. And then off to Kauai for the Kauai Corral.
Yes, the Kauai Corral, I just found this out, is the island's only community chorus, and the music will consist of a wide range of inspiring and entertaining choral music. This is happening, actually, two concerts. One is tomorrow at 7:30 in the KCC Performing Arts Center. And also there's a concert on Sunday, Mother's Day, at 5 p.m. in the St. Regis Grand Ballroom on Kauai. And also performing will be percussionist Dan Spriggs and the Kauai Seventh-day Adventist Children's Choir. Tickets are available at the door.
And what's this at the Hawaii State Art Museum?
That's happening tomorrow. It's a free hands-on activity. People of all ages can learn how to make colorful bookmarks tomorrow. All materials are provided, and then you can take what you make home with you. And this is from 11 to 3 p.m. at the Hawaii State Art Museum downtown, and that's free.
It's always good to hear about those free events, Derek.
Oh, yes, always.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that'll wrap our week. Come Monday, DLNR's Bruce Anderson will be here with a look at the global survey that's leading to the development of the Hawaii Coral Plan.
And we'll get a visit from Hula Rosie with her new program at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like at 808-792-8217. Or if you like email, we have that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on social, on Facebook at The Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
And if you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. And to all moms, a happy Mother's Day. We'll talk on Monday when we pick up The Conversation.